On Thursday, September 16, 1920, a few seconds after the Trinity Church bell had finished tolling noon, the pleasant fall air of downtown Manhattan. Weather clear. Temperature 69 degrees. Market up slightly. Was rent by an enormous and devastating explosion. Emanating from a point on Wall Street, a few yards east of the intersection of Wall and Broad, and directly between the marble edifice of J.P. Morgan and Company and the barred front of the brand-new United States Assay Office, that is to say, from the precise center, geographical as well as metaphorical, of financial America and even of the financial world. The explosion darkened the area for several minutes with a huge cloud of greenish smoke, set fire to awnings 12 stories above the street, broke virtually every window in the immediate vicinity and some as much as a half mile away, and spattered a wide area with hundreds of small shrapnel-like iron slugs that, on later examination, appeared to be fragments of cut-up window sash weights. It pockmarked the austere facade of the Morgan Building at 23 Wall Street, on the southeast corner of the intersection, and blew in all of its north windows, causing a hail of glass fragments to fall on persons on the banking floor below. It bent the heavy bars protecting the Assay Office on the north side of Wall next to the sub-treasury. This building largely escaped interior damage precisely because it had been designed to be a fortress. It shook to the foundations, but by miracle or chance did not materially damage Wall Street's own church, Trinity, which stood, flanked by its famous old graveyard containing the bones of Alexander Hamilton, only a short block from the point of explosion. The toppling of Trinity's Gothic Revival spire, had it occurred, would have symbolized the disruption of things as they were as much as the defacing of Morgan's itself. At the New York Stock Exchange on Broad Street, near the southwest corner of the intersection with Wall, the blast sent hundreds of brokers and traders surging to the center of the trading floor in an effort to avoid glass falling from the room's huge windows. There, driven from Scylla to Charybdis, they were confronted with the prospect of mass extinction by the great glass dome overhead, which threatened to fall but didn't. At the Bankers Trust Company on the northwest corner, broken glass flew like leaves in a gale, and one of the iron slugs whizzed through the office window of Seward Prosser, the bank's president, missing his head by a few inches. Others were less fortunate than Prosser. 30 persons were killed instantly, or nearly so, by the explosion, and injuries befell some 300 more, of whom 10 died later. But none of the dead were the kings and generals of finance, all of whose lives seemed to be as charmed with good fortune as Prosser's. J.P. Morgan, the most famous man in Wall Street, and the public symbol of its power, was on holiday in an English country house. Of the five of his partners who were in the building when it was hit, all escaped injury except Morgan's son Junius, who suffered a minor cut. Of the 30 who died at once, none were brokerage partners or senior bank executives, and only one was identified as a broker. Most of the others were Wall Street's attendants and privates. Young or old, the stenographers, clerks, bookkeepers, messengers, and porters, who with untimely appetite had stepped out of their buildings a minute or two before noon on their way to an early lunch. Three were women, four were teenage clerks or messengers, one was a young banker of 25, another was a retired businessman of 68. The value of the securities lost in the confusion was negligible. And as to property damage, which amounted to $2 or $3 million, the owners of the buildings, or their insurance companies, could easily enough absorb that. Whatever the meaning of the explosion, it left Wall Street's power unscathed.